Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Now, before we get into today's first interview, it's a location piece, but I've got to warn you, contains mature subject matter, so listener discretion is advised. Cam Wells here with
Daniel Brenner.
He's going to be telling me a little bit about his story of disability life. So, what exactly is the nature of your condition?
Well, I had a little accident back in the day. My trauma ended up being a spinal cord injury. I ended up getting shot twice when I was 5 years old back in January 14, 2000. And that was in Detroit, Michigan. So, during that time, I can get right into the story, I'll tell you. I was just at my dad's house, and we were just hanging out on January 14, 2000. And I seen this guy walking around the house, and I was wondering why he had a gun. So I explained to my mother, I asked her, there's a guy with a gun, what is he doing here? So with that going on, it started to get a little bit worse. He actually came into the house. I grabbed my brother, threw him behind the couch, and I actually told him to stay there. I said that the boogeyman was going to come. He believed me, so he actually stayed there. He didn't get hurt during this session. So, but the guy had a 9mm handgun, and he came inside the kitchen, and he asked my father for money and started arguing with him. My dad only had a couple of jars of change for me and my brother. And he's been saving over the years just to give it to us for school later on or anything, you know. But then it started to get more intense. He had his 9mm handgun ready, and my dad didn't have any more money to give him. So he actually came up to me first, and he pistol whipped me in the mouth. And then he pulled it back, and then he shot one bullet on the right side hip, right in the middle of my hip. And one on the other side of the back of my left side, hip. And he also shot my mom twice in her face, shot my dad twice in his chest, and he shot my uncle in his face. And how I said that is, when he did everybody else, he came back and he shot me for the second time, because he thought I was gonna live. So that's why I got the second bullet. But he didn't know how strong I was, really, so he ended up leaving. I ended up hanging out with my brother for a little bit during that time to get him calmed down, and I was staying calm as I could because I didn't know if they were going to come back at. So they left. Now there's a funny part of the story. I was inside the cop car. They came faster than the ambulance, and I asked for apple juice in the cop car, and they gave it to me. They actually had apple juice in a cop car. How funny is that? Like, and I'm still friends with them, Chris and Kim, the police officers.
So I understand that you've taken a sort of self-therapeutic approach using music.
Yeah, music has been always around my family, and I just had to partake it in myself, and it kept me stable to keep me there while I was going through my therapy and my physiotherapy too as well. And it was just therapeutic back to me. And like, if I didn't have anybody around, the music was always there.
So what were some of the challenges in your recovery?
I had to, when everything was over, the story, I was inside the hospital. I was in critical condition. They told me I wasn't going to live again. Like, they thought that I wasn't going to live, like, continue living, because I was in critical condition. But over the couple months, they said that I was going to be all right, but they said I would never walk again. They said that if I did, I would have to have nurses all around me, taking care of me, changing diapers, all that nursing. But as today, I end up pushing all those nurses away over the years. But there was the challenges of learning how to write again, learning how to speak, learning how to communicate with people, trusting people, and going out there and being sociable. And it was just a giving, like a gift to have with music and being involved with going out in the public at the same time, breaking a wall.
So, in your journey, what's been the greatest success moment you've experienced?
I'd have to say, doing everything that I can up to now, 2019, without any parents, is the biggest success that I can do, is showing them off that their son is out here making music for Windsor, Ontario, and doing his dreams and living it to the top.
So, if you could send any message to all the survivors out there who might be uncertain of their own abilities or might just be looking for hope, what would you say?
I'd have to say the grind never stops, and you have to be your own boss. You have to take care of yourself. You have to understand how your body feels. Only you know how you feel. And with that, that will take you a long time teaching yourself and learning about yourself at the same time to be independent. The grind never stops.
So these days, I notice you walk with a crutch, but I take it that's the limit of any mobility or balance you might have?
Yes. Without the crutch, half of my leg is paralyzed, so I would fall on my knee. I would definitely fall over. I'm having a difficult time right now trying to go through the surgeries that I had over the years. I get body fatigue and fibromyalgia, and sometimes my body flares up from overworking out, and that could just be from doing simple tasks such as laundry, moving around, hanging out with friends like for a long time, like the day if I wasn't feeling so good, something could happen and build up. So I have to take it easy, and then I have to learn what my body is doing at that moment, and just take care of yourself. Yeah.
So it's knowing your own self and your own rhythms.
Yes, your own patterns, yeah. And have a schedule, too. Have a schedule is very important.
Makes sense. I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this.
You're very welcome. I'm really glad to share this story, and I try to do my best to explain it in a very nice, settling way. And it's just really real how it happened, and I'm just very glad that I get to share it, because it gives a lot of people extra hope from a big trauma like that, to understand that there is a light out there. They keep going forward.
So. Our show, I'll be chatting with Anna Rita Veltri Fiorino. So, tell me a little bit about your disability story.
Well, in 2008, I found out that I have what's called myopic degeneration in both my eyes and amblyopia. And that's it's a form of age-related macular degeneration. It's not, well, I used to think it wasn't serious because it was I just thought, well, I just couldn't see out of my glasses. So I went back to the eye doctor, and he took pictures of the back of my eye and explained to me that eventually I would be going blind. I would lose my central vision. And that, you know, I had to take precautionary measures in order to keep my eyes safe. So I would start to take vitamins, and then eventually I would need injections in the eyes to slow down the progression of this disorder. They say that it is genetic. I'm the first person that I know of in my family, a family tree, that has what I have. But when I looked back in the history on my mom's side of the family, mom had an uncle who basically saw shadows. And when you do the research on age-related macula, eventually when you start to lose your central vision, you start to see shadows. And I really believe that on my mom's side of the family, this uncle may have had the same disorder as I have today, but it was never identified. Because in those days, there weren't any, you know, labels or any diagnosis. We didn't know what cancer was then. They were just dying. They were sick. And that was it. Today, there's more of a distinction towards disabilities, towards anything cancer-related. So there's a name for everything.
So
it's been 11 years now. And it's been a process, I'll tell you, honestly, because at first, I really didn't like it, and I wasn't ready to accept it because my eyes are everything for me. I do everything, computer, photography. I still drive, gratefully and thankfully. I can still do a lot of the things that I was doing in 2008. I've just had to adjust. I had to make accommodations.
So can you tell me a little bit about some of the coping strategies you've used, some of the best accommodations you've been able to find for yourself?
Coping strategies, I think it's mostly with, first of all, you have to yourself. I have to myself. I had to accept it, and that was the hardest. So I did a lot of therapy. I went to see a counselor. So I utilized Family Service Windsor. They have a great counseling department, and I was able to talk it out because this disease, our disability, caused me to become angry. Why me? Why my eyes? You know, what's going on? Why couldn't it be my hearing? I've worked with children with disabilities when I was a preschool teacher. And so working with them, I helped them adjust to life. So now I had to teach myself to adjust. So the coping, number one, was, you know, working with a counselor to get those tools and those skills to get around it, because to me, vitamins and needles were not just the easiest fix for me. I wanted to make sure that this wasn't going to go any further than what it needed to, so that I could continue seeing and living life accordingly.
So what's been the greatest success you've experienced since your diagnosis?
Oh, greatest success? Actually, I've learned a lot about myself. I've learned that I'm very transparent. I've learned to do a lot of research on the disability. And I've also learned that I have become an advocate, not only for myself, but others with disabilities. Where, you know, like, for example, being disabled, I require, and I don't require the accessibility parking permit because of my eyes. I have very bad knees. So I have the bad knees, which is also hardship for me as well. So I have this permit. So I have become more of an advocate for anyone who is disabled, regardless of whether they're disabled because of their eyes, their hearing, their walking, just anyone with an accessibility. So I find myself always trying to make it better for everyone, including the people that are out there that are not disabled. They are the ones that need to be educated more, because we're in 2019, right? And a lot of people are really, for lack of better words, either not really with the times or clueless, or they don't care. You know, it's not affecting them, so why should they care? So That's one of my biggest successes.
So what message would you send to the community about the need for greater awareness?
Well, the message I would send to the community for better awareness is to actually be open to listening and to, like, for example, don't always concentrate on yourself. If you're going to open a door to get out, you know, look behind you, see if someone's coming. Hold the door open for them. Or if you see a person who is using a walker, help them. You know, load their car or whichever. The accessible buttons on the doors and the accessible parking spots are designated. They're not for everyone. You have to have a permit for that. Educate your children to be more understanding that button is not a toy. It's actually there for a reason. It's for individuals that have a disability that are not able to open the door by themselves. Be more aware. That's what I would like to see.
Well, when it comes to things like the wheelchair button, there is the advantage of sort of temporary use. I mean, someone carrying groceries who just can't get through might have it from a universal design standpoint.
I agree. And I think that is very true. I just think in a sense, when I look at it, I think in a sense the children, because they are our future, need to be educated to understand that the button is used specifically for a person who has a wheelchair, but can also be used for someone who has their hands full. You know, do we have our hands full? Should we be using that button? Can we use the door instead? You know, stuff like that.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Hey Jammers! CJAM's annual week-long fall fundraiser is returning this year from November 8th to November 15th. This is your chance to support local, campus community radio by making a donation to the station or even to your favorite CJAM show. Tune in on November 8th at noon for the kickoff with CJAM staff and listen throughout the week for some special programming. To donate to CJAM's fundraiser, you can call in throughout the week or visit cjam.ca to donate online and check out our donation incentives. Support CJAM, your true sound alternative, during our annual fall fundraiser, November 8th to the 15th.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from robbery survivor Daniel Brenner and from Anarita Veltri Fiorino about her story of disability life. Just a reminder, folks, that Daniel's interview earlier in the show contained mature subject matter. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from our friend Ann Summers, who'll be giving us an update on the sub-minimum wage situation. So, since last time we talked about the sub-minimum wage law, has there been any work to try and get that changed?
There has, and thanks so much for having us back on. One of the most interesting things that we've done since the last time we were with you is that we've really looked at how for-profit businesses are also inadvertently helping sub-minimum wage persist in the United States. And just as a reminder to your listeners, 14C is a provision of the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is a law that was passed in 1938 in the United States, and it's mostly full of great protections for workers here. So we're a big fan of the law in general, but there's a provision in the law that allows for the payment of wages below the federal minimum wage to people who have disabilities, and that is the area of the law that we're looking to see overturned. So in the fall of last year, we put a report out that did a pretty deep dive on 14C in a way that had never been done before. And we looked at the types of tasks that are performed by employees who receive sub-minimum wages and the types of contracts that those that their employers had with for-profit businesses. And what we found was pretty interesting. We found, for instance, that the Bureau of Labor Statistics here in the U.S. Confirms that the type of jobs that they're doing for subminimum wages are largely some of the most vulnerable to automation in the future. And why that was an important finding for us was that as long as 14C persists and individuals are doing these rote tasks and they're not actually getting trained for anything that can become a competitive integrated employment opportunity in the future, we're really, as a national, in terms of national policy goals, we're really failing these people, not only with respect to their wages, but also we're not providing them any training to transition to anything other than what they're doing when automation eliminates their roles that they're currently doing. So that was a pretty significant finding. Perhaps more interesting to your listeners, however, was that we found a couple of things. We found that although many of the 14C subminimum wage nonprofit employers that pay their employees subminimum wages, and again, we're not just talking about, you know, 25 cents less than the minimum wage. In most instances, this is, or I should say in many instances, this can be as low as a penny an hour that people are getting paid. So this is a pretty egregious egregious thing. A lot of those employers are saying you can't get rid of this provision in the law because we'd go out of business if we paid our employees minimum wage. And they're using that argument. But when we pulled their tax documents here in the U.S. and we looked at their reported revenues and the income of their top executives, we found that those statements were pretty unpersuasive. As just one example, we looked at the IRS Form 990 tax documents, and it revealed that the combined total annual revenue of the top 10 employers that use subminimum wage was nearly $523 million.
So,
and
how do you go about challenging them when they say they'd go out of business in regards to paying a fair wage?
Well, I think the report that we put out was a step in that direction by airing this information. Up until this point, if a member of Congress is confronted by an employer that happens to be in their district that says this and maybe tells their member of Congress, you don't want to be associated with eliminating jobs in your district, well, there's almost nothing more stomach-curdling to a member of Congress than you know, the fear that they, that on their watch, that they would be involved in a vote that would result in people from their hometown losing their jobs. And that's another threat that's often put forward in terms of eliminating 14C is going to eliminate jobs. And so I think when we put this report out, we're really shining a light on a more total picture of what's going on. And just to close that loop, the top employer on that list for that I just cited is actually located in California, and they have an annual revenue of nearly $105 million from recycling operations. Their CEO is making over $1.1 million a year in annual salary, and yet they are continuing to pay 1,790 people with disabilities less than the minimum wage. So we're talking pretty egregious statistics here. So I think shining a light on those pieces of information and getting that the totality of that information before members of Congress has been immensely helpful. The other thing that we looked at in the report, Cam, was a lot of for-profit businesses are benefiting from subminimum wage, and they don't know it. And what I mean by that is businesses, big businesses throughout North America take advantage of, they enter into contracts in their supply chain for anything and everything. So if you're a large box shop, for instance, and you have inventory coming into your warehouses every day on trucks, and you have things coming out of the boxes, and then you have these boxes that are typically thrown in the alley, they need to be broken down. This is just one example. So if you're a big business, you're going to, through your supply chain at your distribution centers, enter into contracts with other businesses to do things like break down cardboard for recycling, as just one example. And I just cited that example of the California employer who utilizes subminimum wage, and their business is recycling. So let's say you're Walmart, and I'm not picking on Walmart, but I'm just using them as a hypothetical example. Let's say you're Walmart, and you enter into a supply chain contract with this nonprofit from California, and they're able to bid and be the low-cost bid on the contract because they're utilizing subminimum wage employment. The contract may provide them, for ease of math, let's say $100,000 for a small distribution center. $100,000 is getting funneled into this nonprofit, but the people who are actually breaking down the boxes and providing the labor may see $10 of that, as just an extreme example. And so what we looked at in this report was, how prevalent is 14C being utilized in supply chain operations of giant for-profit enterprises? And we found, surprisingly, it's actually quite common.
What I'm wondering about is, do you find there's any sort of ethical issue with those who might not necessarily know that someone somewhere with a disability is being paid less so they can save?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't want any of your listeners to think that we are painting with a broad brush that for-profit businesses as being evil or anything like that. Quite to the contrary, what we've also found in the course of the research is that almost 100% of the time, the for-profit business has absolutely no idea that this is going on. They are, you know, signing a good faith contract with a vendor that's got a low cost bid, and they're not, I guess they're stopping their thought process there. So it's business as usual for them. Most of them, in fact, some of the businesses that we found in our surveys that were utilizing 14C subminimum wages in their supply chain are actually regularly awarded for their exemplary behavior in hiring people with disabilities in their storefronts and in their businesses. So clearly there's a deep commitment at the corporate level for a lot of businesses that want to do the right thing for people with disabilities and hire them competitively in an integrated way. And so when this is brought to their attention, they're horrified.
My friends, unbelievable though it is that any business would try and protect itself at the expense of its workers to denigrate the work of a person with a disability in this way, to me, just seems incomprehensible. The fact of the matter is, they're putting in equal work, sometimes at greater effort. Who are we to say, in this day and age, when we know better, that your work is more valuable because you get around a certain way, or you see a certain way, or you hear a certain way? No, it's the same work, it's the same result, and it is frankly appalling that these employers are using this as an excuse, bullying congressmen into saying that jobs would be lost. I mean, lies and myths like this only go away if somebody has the wherewithal to challenge them. And the fact is, they have to be challenged. We have to keep pushing forward. You know this to be true, my friends. That the instant we say, it's okay that this is happening, society accepts that, and progress ceases to be made. But between you, me, and all those out there, we can do better, people. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.